This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For more information, check out nhhca.org. We're at New England College inside the pub where the acoustics are tremendous. The show is going to sound really, really good. I might do my show here. No, probably not all the time. But this is a really good spot where Pete Buttigieg spoke earlier today. He's going to speak with us just a few moments here on the shows. We welcome in Paul Steinhauser. Paul, how are you?
Good to join you. A snowy week and a busy week on the campaign trail here in New Hampshire.
Indeed, and it gets busier this weekend as John Kerry is going to be here in the Granite State. Nope, he is
He's not running the presidential
field. He is going to be here with Joe Biden, who he endorsed earlier today on Thursday. Also was with Warren's in the Granite State, and Pete Buttigieg wrapping up his trip to the Granite State tomorrow. We've had an individual leave the race, actually a couple individuals leave the race this week, as Kamala Harris left the race, Steve Bullock left the race as well. So a lot of news.
And your favorite, Joe Sestak,
who
walked the width of New Hampshire, gone as well.
And that was it for him. I think he walked like into the Atlantic Ocean after that. Anyway, what do you see as being, you know, the big themes right now? We're going to get to Harris and, you know, what that means, but what do you see as being the big themes that stand out to you as we're, you know, less than 9 weeks from voting?
I know. The clock is ticking, especially here in New Hampshire. Let's be honest. You know, we're going to take a break in about 2 weeks for the holidays. Once that presidential debate on December 19th is over, I think you're going to see activity on the campaign trail kind of quiet down until after the new year. And then basically, once we start up in January, New Hampshire's got about 2 weeks, the first half of the month, to enjoy the candidates, because after that, let's be honest, Chris, all the action's going to be in Iowa in the back half of January leading up to that February 3rd caucus. And then once the Iowa caucuses are over, everybody who's remaining in the race comes here to New Hampshire for those 8 days in between the two contests. So not a lot of time right now.
No. I mean,
less than you'd think, even though it's 2 weeks, 2 months, and 1 week away. It's a lot less than you really would think.
And low-information voters are not paying any attention to this race for the next 4 weeks. Let's be honest. There's Christmas parties, Secret Santas. There's an impeachment situation in D.C. There is not going to be any interest paid. So we're not going to see any real movement in this race, which leads us to the big question, which is, if you're a second-tier candidate, if you're Andrew Yang, we're going to hear from in just a little bit on the program, if you're Cory Booker, if you're Amy Klobuchar, you know, you're constantly saying, well, Bill Clinton was at this point in 1992, and you know, Barack Obama was not at the lead. But the difference is that there's four candidates that are all in position right now. It's kind of like in baseball, where if you're five games out and you're trying to get that final spot in the wild card, and there's four teams you got to leapfrog in front of you, there's a lot of things that have to happen in order for your campaign to have success, or your team to have success. The other teams have to lose. You have to do really good. And so there's a lot of dynamics at play where you can point to the candidates that did have success, but guess what? The lion's share of individuals who are in the same spot as you lost. So are we in that spot in 2020? Or can one of these other candidates mount some sort of a triumphant comeback to get to where Biden, Sanders, Buttigieg, and Warren are?
It's difficult. I'm not writing anybody off, though, but it is difficult. Hey, go back 4 years. Chris Christie was a nobody in the autumn of 2015. And then at the end of the year, right after Thanksgiving, early December, he caught fire.
Yeah.
And he started rising in the polls and a lot of energy. But guess what? By the time we got to the New Hampshire primary in early February, that had dissipated. So can it happen? Yes, Christie's a good example. But will it happen? Ugh, the odds are really stacked against you. Michael Bennett, one of the lower tier candidates,
right,
who's not on the debate stage, starting tomorrow, five straight days here in New Hampshire. He's putting a lot of resources here. He's hoping to do, you know, catch a little lightning in a bottle here in New Hampshire. But it's tough. He's overshadowed. And as you said, nobody's really paying attention right now, at least when it comes to those low propensity voters.
Right. So I think that you know, as we look at the race right now, we're going to hear from Andrew Yang in just a moment on Kamala Harris dropping out of the race. We're going to hear from Pete Buttigieg here at New England College about how you know, he sees the race right now and some of his opponents in this contest, as well as some of the key issues. But I think the key point is that it is getting late early, to quote Yogi Berra, and that we are in real time 9 weeks out from voting, but in campaign time, we're really only 5 weeks out from voting. And that makes the challenge for Deval Patrick, for a Michael Bennett, for Andrew Yang, and others who are behind all that more difficult. So, yes, it is a big challenge for them. But what is so remarkable is that you can make an argument for all four of the top four candidates, not just winning New Hampshire, but winning the nomination.
Yeah, that's what makes it so fascinating at this point. There is no true front runner anymore. We have that clear top tier with the possibility of maybe another person entering that top tier. But this is a wide open game. And of course, New Hampshire, we always say this, but it is true, and polls back it up. You know, late deciders here in New Hampshire for a lot of reasons. And also the results in Iowa will heavily influence what happens here. And we're seeing it in the polls right now. The most recent polls indicate double digits when it comes to true voters who are undecided. And among those who are backing a candidate, in one poll, up to half of those people said, well, they could change their minds.
The other thing that's interesting, too, is that late deciders here in New Hampshire tend to be independent, undeclared voters, you know, who make determinations as to what they're going to do late. And they also tend to be more moderate. You look at Hillary Clinton as an example. She gets pushed over the top by independent moderate voters in 2008. John McCain, you know, the same thing. And, you know, I think that that is going to be an interesting dynamic here in this race. Are the late deciders going to, you know, be individuals that back Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, or are they going to back more Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden? And the other piece is that Bernie Sanders polled a huge number in 2016. And I feel that as we get closer, a lot of those voters who may be with an Andrew Yang now, or maybe with you know, Tulsi Gabbard, or undecided, if they see that Bernie Sanders has a chance to win and Andrew Yang doesn't, how does that affect their voting? Because polling certainly affects individuals' psyche, and a lot of times people like to be winners.
You make a good point, but I will say this. In 2016, Bernie Sanders, what, won 60% of the vote here in the Democratic presidential primary. Not all those people were progressives. A lot of those people who voted for Bernie in 2016, they hated Hillary. They just did not like Hillary Clinton, and that's why, even though they may have been, you know, not big fans of Bernie and his progressive agenda, they voted for him. So I'm wondering how much of that support he'll get this time, because this time around he's got a lot of options when it comes to the more centrist lane of the party, as you mentioned, Biden and Buttigieg, of course, but also a Klobuchar, maybe even a Cory Booker to a degree in there, Michael Bennett, and a few of the others. So there are plenty of places for these voters to go this time around.
Do you feel that this is going to be the field once we get to voting, or is there a possibility that we see more candidates drop out and more candidates getting in? That's extremely problematic because of deadlines to be on the ballot. So I think that the field is set in terms of, thankfully, more candidates getting into the race. But do you feel that there's going to be more individuals drop out, or is there really a reason to drop out other than not having any more money? Because you have Delaney still out there, Julian Castro is still out there, Marianne Williamson is still out there. These individuals have been cast aside in terms of the DNC debate regulated part of the process, but are still going. Do you feel, and you know, between all of them, they're going to pull, you know, like 5-6%, which
total
could go in, yes, exactly, which could go in different places. Do you feel that everybody that's in the race right now stays in it? I think we could have maybe one, two more people drop out before voting.
I thought Bennett would drop out. He's got a day job back in the U.S. Senate, but he sure doesn't sound like he's dropping out anytime soon.
I think he's trying to build a name for himself, yeah, for the future.
I think he stays in.
Yeah.
His campaign's not spending a lot of money,
right,
so he can do that. John Delaney's not going to drop out. He's self-funding. He's worth millions.
He's just going to stay in Iowa?
I think, well, and he comes here, too. Both of the early voting states. But yeah, I don't see him dropping out. Marianne Williamson is so unique and so different that I don't see her dropping out anytime soon either. Castro's a different story.
I think Castro would be the one.
Yeah, he may run out of money. And I don't see Booker dropping out, but keep your eyes on him, because of all these campaigns, he's the one that's spending the money, right?
Right.
And if the money runs dry, then he's in trouble. But yeah, I don't think the field's going to get that much smaller. And remember, we just got two candidates who jumped in just a few weeks ago, Deval Patrick and Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah, I don't feel like Booker is going to drop out either, because even if he doesn't make the December debate to me doesn't really matter. It's more about the January and February debates, and if he can, and trying to get to those. Like, if he can't get on the debate stage in January and he doesn't have any money anymore,
then you got trouble.
Yeah, then you got to pull.
I spoke to two Booker advisors who wished to remain anonymous, who said the same thing. Nobody's going to be watching the December debate. Sure, we'd like to be there, but it's not a game changer if we don't make the debate. So that won't change.
And out of all the candidates still out there that could rise, I see Booker as having the best chance to have a debate where he just makes the night. He just takes over the night, takes over the stage. Very similar to what Buttigieg did two debates ago, where he made everything about him. And despite the fact that he was not one of the front-running candidates at that point, he was the center of attention. He was going to go after one candidate on this, one candidate on something else. He laid out how it was going to take place, and there he was debating everyone throughout the course of the contest. Well, they were not really debating him, and that was one of the places where he rose. Now, I could totally see that happening with Cory Booker. I don't really see that happening with Steyer. I don't really see that happening with Amy Klobuchar. But Booker could put together a debate performance where all the people have been saying, why is Cory Booker not having more support? I could see the media totally going in on Booker and being like, wow, this was his night. Breakout night. But it's a big jump to go from 3% to, you know, one of the top three or four.
Yeah, you know, listen, he had a very good debate in November in Atlanta, and he raised about $1 million in the 2 days after that debate. Problem is, he's not going to have a chance to do that most likely in December this month because it's very, very slim chance he's going to make the debate stage. So if it does happen, it's going to be probably the next debate after that. It's probably going to be late January in Iowa. So that's pushing it. That's getting close. I'll say one other thing about debates. Other than the Kamala Harris takedown of Joe Biden in the first debate, which boosted significantly.
And Gabbard taking down
And Gabbard
Harris.
Then taking down Harris a month later.
But didn't help her. Didn't help Gabbard.
Didn't help
much.
Gabbard.
Helped her a little bit.
Yeah. That was about it, though. The debates this cycle have not been that influential. And that's a change from the 2012 and 2016 cycles on the Republican side. The debates.
Front runners each time.
Exactly. Yeah. So very different dynamic.
And Trump really made his name in the debates. But he was, because of his cachet, his name ID, and his celebrity, he was going to be a candidate to be reckoned with and was going to have success. But everybody thought that he was going to be kind of like a, you know, Marianne Williamson or Andrew Yang type candidate, where there's a niche, they have some success, but they don't have a shot at the nomination. But Trump's messaging was good and his debate performances were really good because it's all everybody talked about. They played it over and over again and he systematically went after and knocked down everybody in the room and he made it into a must-watch entertainment event. These Democratic debates have drawn really good numbers in terms of viewership, but there haven't been big moments during the course of these debates, for the most part.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, everybody remembers that debate in the summer of 2015, the first Republican debate in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah.
From then on in, it was Trump steamrolling get started. These debates, though, I will say on these Democratic debates, the ratings were sky high for the summer debates. They've been deteriorating over the autumn, and I'm wondering, you know, if that'll continue. I'm assuming it will in this December debate. But maybe they'll pick up again in January.
Yeah, the numbers have, I mean, still, the numbers have been good.
They're good.
For considering it's a presidential primary and we're well before the voting begins. The numbers have been good, but yes, they have been dipping and they're not where, you know, the numbers were for watching Trump the last time around because he really made the debate. Let's talk a little bit about Kamala Harris and also a little bit about the interesting nature of an attack that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez pushed forth on Andrew Yang and why I think it's significant. First, Harris. I thought that Harris was going to be, you know, basically the Marco Rubio of this race, a person that was going to have a shot at the nomination, but was going to be stuck in between the progressives and the centrists and was never really going to find a home, but maybe with a split field would be able to find that home and be seen as the best candidate to take on Trump based upon her debate and intellectual acumen. That didn't happen. And she became basically the Scott Walker of this race instead, as she did not make it to voting.
Good analogy. Good analogy. Walker was one of the rock stars when that when the 2016.
I remember when he first got in it. It was like he was the guy. Everybody forgets that, but he was the front runner.
She was the guy. She was the gal, no doubt about that. Listen, she had the impeccable resume. She was the next Barack Obama, a female version of Barack Obama. She had everything going for her. She had name recognition, even though she had only been elected to the Senate in 2016. A couple things that were her undoing. First of all, there was always tension right off the bat in her campaign and a lot of division and never a clear path for which way they wanted to go. Secondly, the top issue so far in this Democratic presidential primary since the beginning of the year has been
Medicare for all.
Mm-hmm. And she never had a good answer.
Well,
she
never clearly, issue on policy, it's been that. The Trump
policy.
Is the biggest.
Yeah, but on
thing.
Policy.
Yeah, policy.
And that issue just destroyed her. That really crushed her.
Yeah. And that was right off the bat, too.
Yeah,
where
even
she,
before the debates.
Yeah, she was. She did the town hall of Jake Tapper, and she said she was for eliminating private insurance. Then she had to backtrack on that. There wasn't a clear definition of who she was going to be as a candidate or what was going to be her policy positions. And you're in a field where everyone's pretty clearly defined. And Biden's Biden, Sanders is Sanders, and Warren is Warren. And she was, again, caught in between trying to figure out who she was. Is she the tough prosecutor who's going to go mano a mano with Donald Trump and rip him to shreds and Joe Biden and rip them to shreds?
Mm-hmm.
Or is she the person that's going to tell one-liners and laugh at her own jokes? And when you people don't know who you are, you have to establish a clear identity early on and said, this is who the person is. And then you can start to show different parts of your personality afterwards, that you're not just the tough prosecutor, but you're also this. But she never really established herself and her identity to the point of which where she could introduce different parts of her personality that made her more I don't want to say understandable, but where there's a greater understanding as to who she was as an individual.
Yeah, that's a great point. And let me bring it down to New Hampshire, to the New Hampshire level. I wrote about this in the Concord Monitor this week. New Hampshire, she never really figured out what to do
and
what role to play here in New Hampshire. When she first came here in February, a few weeks after she jumped into the race, she got a lot of questions about what her commitment to New Hampshire would be. Not because we doubted it, but there was a national narrative from the media that she was going to bypass or not really concentrate in New Hampshire, to concentrate more on South Carolina with that large African-American vote down there, and her home state of California, which is the largest of the Super Tuesday states to vote right after the early states go. She defended herself at the time, saying she's going to be here a lot. But that was more lip service. I will say this, though. In that first trip, an eye-popping 1,500 people in a snowstorm came out to see her in Portsmouth.
Right?
Yeah, which to date I still think is the largest, if you include the people who are waiting outside who couldn't even get in to the South Church, the largest event of any kind other than on the President Trump's rally.
People were more interested in her than any of the other candidates. There was an intrigue about her.
Fascination.
Yeah.
But... Well, no, even before that, she did build up a formidable staff here. But by the late spring, early summer, it was pretty clear she wasn't going to be spending nearly as much time here as everybody else. The other teams, the other campaigns, their staffs got bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Harris has stayed the same. She came back in September for the state party convention. Again, we asked her whether it's a top priority. She said yes, but that was her last trip here. She soon shuttered her operations in mid-October here, and that kind of foreshadowed the ultimate downfall for her.
So let's hear from Andrew Yang right now, who was in the Granite State and responded to her dropping out.
Yeah, and I asked him, this was up at New London College just before he sat down with you, I asked him, would you consider her as a running mate if, perchance, you win the nomination? Take a listen.
I think most people underestimate the human element of running for president. I've been with Kamala dozens of times now on the trail. I'd consider her a friend. We have each other's cell phone numbers and text occasionally. And it makes me very sad to see her drop out. She has a lot to offer the country. It's more human than people think. I'm going to miss seeing her a great deal.
It's a long way to go, but would you consider her, if you win the nomination, is she somebody you could maybe consider as a running mate?
I would 100% love to work with Kamala in some capacity. We have a lot of problems to solve in this country, and she's going to be part of the solution, I'm sure.
There's Andrew Yang with Paul Steinhauser up at Colby Sawyer College. Very interesting what took place in regards to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a huge Bernie Sanders supporter.
Huge!
Went out to Iowa and barnstormed with Bernie. We haven't seen her here in the Granite State as of yet. But I think this is interesting because one of the keys to Bernie Sanders winning New Hampshire and winning the nomination is, as we talked about before, the ability to bring home his voters. Andrew Yang has been able to siphon off a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters and potential Bernie Sanders supporters. And using Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to speak directly to Yang supporters, and I think is something that the Sanders campaign is going to do consistently.
Yeah, but in this case, it may backfire, because why is Andrew Yang where he is right now? A, he's different, but B, it's UBI, the Universal Basic Income, his freedom dividend. That has caught on it. Everybody wants $1,000 a month, right? So
some people have noted that Yang should be polling a lot better, considering that he is going to give $1,000 a month to everybody.
But he's doing pretty, for somebody who nobody even heard of about 9 months ago, he's firmly in that middle tier, and he makes the debate stage when others don't. She recently criticized, she called the freedom dividend regressive. She wasn't specifically saying Yang, but she was talking about universal basic income. It's pretty clear she meant Yang, obviously. She called it regressive and a Trojan horse. I had a chance to ask Yang about that and whether this was purely politics because AOC is backing Bernie Sanders, like you mentioned, or not. And here's what Yang told us.
No, I haven't sat down with Alexandria. It could just be politics. Like, I'm very optimistic that if she understood the freedom dividend, she'd be excited about it. She's demonstrated openness to universal basic income in the past. And I think she'll be very excited when she sees what it would mean in real life.
All right, that is Andrew Yang with Paul Steinhauser. Up next here on the program, Pete Buttigieg joins us to sit down for a conversation here at New England College. Then more with Yang, and we'll come back and talk about the action on the campaign trail here in the Granite State. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. We're joined by Mayor Pete Buttigieg here at New England College, and continues to do very well in the polls, particularly here in New Hampshire and in Iowa, considered by me and others as one of the leading candidates for President of the United States. But we continue to hear this narrative over and over and over again that you have difficulty with African-American voters. And I'm curious as to where you see that coming from, and how does your campaign going about addressing it and the perpetuation of this narrative?
Well, outreach to African-American voters is extremely important to us because it's such an important part, not only of how to win, but how to deserve to win and govern. Look, racial inequality is one of the biggest problems that our country faces, and in many ways it's gotten worse. You know, African-American home ownership is at its lowest rate since the Federal Housing Act was passed, and certainly in the climate we're in right now and under this presidency, we're seeing more and more expressions of outright hate happening, and there's so many reasons why we need to dismantle institutional racism. Now, I've put forward the most comprehensive plan yet delivered by a presidential candidate on tackling these issues. They're well received when I have a chance to share it. But we're also encountering a lot of voters who have not yet really felt like they've had a chance to get to know me. And the good news is when they do, our support grows. But we know we got to do the work. It's why we're coming off a Southern tour where we began with a conversation with Reverend William Barber at his church in North Carolina, visited not just population centers in South Carolina, but places like Allendale County. Hadn't seen a Democratic or any presidential candidate come through in more than a decade. And touring through Alabama, visiting with community leaders there, visiting the National Memorial on racial violence and lynching, making sure that we're showing our work, showing who I am. And I believe that's going to pay off. Look, it's no secret there's one candidate who has a major advantage right now among African-American voters. But I don't think that's permanent, and I think it's our job to go out there and earn our share of the vote.
I'm looking at one of the crosstabs from a recent poll in South Carolina indicated that 60% of African-American voters did not know enough about you to push forth an opinion, which is rarely pushed forth. But it seems like there's a lot of hate which is surrounding your campaign. There's obviously the event with African-American supporters and individual coming up and taking the microphone. You've been received a number of individuals protesting you for various purposes on the campaign trail. So I'm curious as to how, you know, you've talked a lot about healing. How do you go about creating an environment where these individuals have a better understanding, or how do you reconcile this type of behavior?
Well, there is a lot of negativity that often spills over from Twitter, which doesn't quite reflect real life, but sometimes it winds up having real life consequences. And what we saw the other night was a good example. Here you had a group of highly respected African-American elected officials and other supporters talking about what we've been doing in the community, and then somebody, I think propelled by an opposition campaign, literally tried to take the mic from an African-American leader. And so it shows the work that we've got to do to make sure that, first of all, a sense of common purpose is established, but also just make sure that the truth gets out there. And that's what we're being very intentional with as a campaign.
You've been making a lot of comparisons, more lately in the last couple of weeks, I think, to Barack Obama when it comes to both your age. You were both very young when you first ran for president, and your message of hope and change. This morning, you got some big endorsements, three major Obama-era officials. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, this also comes at the time where the former president reportedly questioned whether Joe Biden, his vice president, was connecting with voters. So are you the true, I guess, person to carry on the mantle of the Obama administration rather than the vice president?
Well, I think every campaign in every era is different. And I recognize that while I'm flattered by a lot of comparisons and see some parallels with 2008, we're also at a different moment. But I will say one of the reasons why I really appreciate the endorsement of the folks who came through today is we're talking about people who understand the presidency very intimately and very well. And for them to agree that I'm the right person to step into that office and that role at a time like this really validates what we're saying as a campaign.
But at the same time today, the former vice president got an endorsement from one of the top people in the Obama administration, that being John Kerry, of course. I'm wondering, does that cut both ways then?
Well, look, I have never been part of the Washington establishment, and I recognize that there are relationships among senators who have been together on Capitol Hill as long as I've been alive, and that is what it is. But what I know is that we're able, not just through endorsements, but through the most important endorsement of all, which is how voters feel, to continue growing our base and growing toward a victory.
In looking at polls here in New Hampshire, it indicates that there's a lot of comparables between your supporters and also Joe Biden's supporters, and that you've been able to draw actually from a number of his supporters amongst independents and Democrats as well. Do you have a concern about Joe Biden's stability in terms of being a commander in chief? That he pushed out forth a video about leaders across the world mocking President Trump, but with some of the vice president's behavior, do you have any concern at all that he would, in some circumstances, embarrass the country on a world stage?
Well, let me answer the question by talking about what I think I can bring to the office, which is a fresh vision and coupled with a steady hand on what it's going to take to really not just overcome the chaos of the Trump era, but lay out what the future has to look like. The next president is going to have to set the terms of not just American policy, but global engagement for the next half century, because these next few years, even just the one term coming up of the next president, that first term, I believe will be the critical years in which the trajectory of the international order is going to be set up for the future. Mm-hmm. And so it means being ready not only to validate the best in America's tradition and America's past, but to really have an understanding of where we are headed. And it's why I think I'm offering the best outlook and the best solutions.
Elizabeth Warren has a lot of plans, a lot of policies she's put out there. She touts herself, among other things, as being the candidate with the best plans for education. Do you agree?
Well, I think we're the candidate with the best plans. Of course, that's not going to surprise you, but I believe that our policies, both in their specificity, if you go to peepforamerica.com and check out what we've put forward, and in their ability to solve problems and do it in a way that engages the American people rather than polarizes us, I think that's the right answer. And that's true on healthcare. It's true on education, especially when it comes to higher education. You know, my plan is to make sure that cost will never be a barrier for anyone who wants to go to college, making tuition completely free for the first 80% of Americans, and a sliding scale past that for all but the top 10% of Americans by income. And I just don't think it makes sense to subsidize the college tuition of the kids of millionaires and billionaires. I think my plan is more responsible, it's more affordable, and by my lights, it's more progressive.
Are Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders making promises they can't keep to voters? And what do you see that being a concern That you have individuals who are supporting those two under the auspice that certain things are going to take place. As an example, Elizabeth Warren said the other day that she was going to be the last president elected by the Electoral College and it would be abolished. And we know, obviously, the difficult hurdles there. Is it problematic, in your view, for these candidates to be saying things are going to take place as if they're actuality when, indeed, they are, you know, deeply challenging?
It's one thing to motivate folks toward big, bold change. That's what I seek to do every day. It's another to say things like that are very difficult to justify in terms of what it's actually going to take to get something done. It is precisely because I know that it will take years and years and years to, for example, fix the Electoral College, that I think we need to advocate it for it today and start pushing on it today. When you have things like a healthcare plan that has a disagreement to the tune of more than $10 trillion just over how much it even is going to cost, mm-hmm. I do think there is the risk of setting up the American people for disappointment when it's going to take a mighty effort to deliver the things that right. I'm proposing too. But the things I'm proposing, we have explained exactly how to pay for them. And crucially, we have an American majority ready to back us on these efforts as long as we can hold that majority together and not let it get blown up.
Got another debate coming up in a week and a half. Right now, only white people are on that stage. Nobody of color, no diversity. And I'm wondering, do you think the DNC needs to change the rules to be a little more inclusive when it comes to the next debates?
I'm going to leave the rules to the DNC. We play by the rules as we have from January, when the big goal of my campaign was to just get on a debate stage at all. We've now had 5 televised national debates, some of them with so many candidates they had to split it into 2 nights. And I am proud to have been part of a historically diverse field. And I think that the diversity of all of the candidates in the race has been so important. And I hope that what each of the candidates, whatever combination of people does get on the debate stage, I hope what each of them bring is not overlooked.
Final question is in regards to the climate. And you have proposed, as have a number of the other candidates, sweeping changes in how Americans would have to live their lives in order to try to assuage the effects of climate change. But you have huge polluters such as China and India, which continue to use coal and don't see any real change in that taking place. How do you get them to alter their course as president? Can you do that as president? And if you cannot, are our efforts, perhaps for naught?
This is one of the reasons why American global leadership is so important. As it was in securing the world for freedom and democracy in the 20th century, I think American leadership is going to be required in order to deliver climate security in the 21st. The reality is America cannot do this alone. The reality is also that the world cannot do this without America, without the world's largest economy. And so we need to be leading with all of the tools in our toolkit, diplomatic, economic, and other tools to make sure that we move toward a new climate future. The reality is that every country has a lot to lose if we go on the business-as-usual path. Mm-hmm. Every country, including China and India, will experience colossal destruction if we don't act in these next few years. What we've got to do is make sure that we set up a global diplomatic and economic framework that is going to meet the interests of all of our respective countries and show American leadership while we do it.
How many years will it take to change the course, in your view? Was this a generational type thing, particularly in regards to China and India?
The scientists have told us that we've got till about 2030, that's the deadline. In some ways, that means the true deadline is 2020, because if we don't have the right mm-hmm. White House, we're never going to make it. And so we really need to look at this decade we're about to launch, as the decisive one for whether we will succeed or fail to meet this deep existential threat that hangs over the entire century we're living in.
Mayor Pete, as always, appreciate your time. Great to see you, and enjoy your time here in the great state of New Hampshire.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
All right.
That was Mayor Pete Buttigieg. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Andrew Yang is next. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.
Joined by Andrew Yang, I want to start off with Kamala Harris leaving the presidential contest and your takeaways on that, and then we'll get kind of into the broader dialogue about what that means with her leaving, while so many other candidates who are anti-quote-unquote establishment continue on as you are.
People underestimate the humanity of running for president. I have been with Kamala over a dozen times, not just at debates, but in
town halls and meetings in the early states, and I'm going to miss seeing her on the trail. I'm stunned that she's suspending her campaign, but we'll hear from Kamala again, and I expect she and I will be working together in D.C. before too long.
We talked about this the other day, and one of the major dynamics we've seen in this campaign is that anything that is establishment or in some way can be seen as establishment. She was the district attorney in California, worked away obviously to become a United States senator, was running a left-of-center type of campaign. Those individuals seem to be falling by the wayside, while yourself, Pete Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders is kind of an insider, and he's been in government for so long, but has seemed as an outsider. That seems to be a big theme, where you're opening a new office here, you've raised $2 million, and you began this race along with Buttigieg as the longest of long shots.
Yeah, we raised $2 million in just a week, and we're growing while other campaigns are shrinking, because many people here in New Hampshire realize that our government is decades behind the curve, it's not solving our problems, and we need a new way forward. Unfortunately, that new way forward is unlikely to come from Washington, D.C. itself. It's going to come from people outside of D.C., and the people in New Hampshire know that.
Do you feel that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, despite Elizabeth Warren fighting against Wall Street for many years and proposing various things that are certainly populist, and Bernie Sanders, who has championed many progressive issues for many years, do you feel that they're also kind of tainted by D.C. and the fact that they have not been able to bring about the type of change that they've advocated for?
Well, I certainly wouldn't take it that far, but I do think that it's going to be difficult to get things done in Washington after the election, and it's going to take someone who can bring people together from both sides of the aisle, who's drawing in independents and disaffected Trump voters and Republicans that just wants to propose solutions that will improve our way of life, and I believe I'm that candidate.
Here in December on the program, we're focusing on foreign policy of the candidates, because I feel like that has not really been discussed near as much. And how would you frame your vision in regards to your role as Commander-in-Chief and America's role in the world?
Well, it was James Mattis that said that if you invest more in diplomats, you have to spend less on ammunition. And that's where I am. I've signed a pledge to end the forever wars. We need to reinvest in and rebuild our partnerships and alliances and let our longstanding allies know that America is back and we're here for good.
How would you go about negotiating with individuals like a Kim Jong-un or a Vladimir Putin? Because to me, one of the major fallacies, if you will, of the Trump presidency is how he has devalued this country and put us side by side, flagged side by side with many individuals where it feels that the American flag should not be in North Korea or in Russia. How would you go about determining the power of the presidency and who you go about negotiating with and how?
Well, to me, the mistake is not sitting down with leaders that we have dramatic disagreements with. The problem is sitting down with them and getting nothing in return. I know that's not the way to accomplish America's goals and further our national interest abroad. So we have to have clear goals for every interaction and negotiation. And if we're going to sit down with leaders, we have to know that we're going to get something significant out of it.
Would you have preconditions in regards to meeting with any individual?
Well, to me, that's the job of your State Department and diplomatic staff, to have a whole series of meetings that culminate in the meeting that's actually going to seal a deal and get something done. You don't have the exploratory meeting between the two heads of state.
Mikhail Gorbachev talked the other day about the difficulty and challenges of the Russia-United States relationship and where that relationship could be headed, and he had concern in regards to that. How do you view our relationship from an economic perspective with Russia and what should take place with the sanctions, but also their level of interference that we have seen and that has been clearly indicated by our intelligence officials? How do you go about dealing with Vladimir Putin, and what has Trump done wrong in that realm?
Russia is not a true economic rival to us, but it has been a geopolitical rival and threat because of its undermining of our democracy. They have found a vulnerability in our system, and they're exploiting it to its maximal extent. So what we have to do is be realistic about who we're competing with on what grounds. The economic rival is China. Mm-hmm. The geopolitical rival is Russia. You approach them in different ways, but geopolitically, the way forward is to try to isolate Russia, build an international consensus with different partners and allies to try and show Russia that continuing to try and undermine our democracy is going to have significant consequences that they do not want on their heads.
Obviously, you mentioned China and the fact that they have made leaps and bounds in regards to their economy. They continue to grow. They continue to be focused on that in a very singular and impressive type of fashion, while we have been focused on a lot of other different things in our country and slow and reacting. How should the United States work with China? What have you liked or not liked in regards to how the president has dealt with it? I think that obviously trade deals need to be renegotiated, but I think we're getting back to, you know, the conditions upon meeting individuals, where if you're going to have a renegotiation, you need to have an end plan and how you are a strategy for how you're going to renegotiate.
You know, it's really disheartening, Chris, is it seems like the ultimate outcome of all of this trade war with China is going to be point A, like where we were in the first place. But with higher costs, and there's been massive economic harm to American farms and businesses around the country. So to me, the path forward with China is to, again, rebuild an international set of norms that helps bring China to the table and gets real concessions out of them. Doing it unilaterally is not the ideal. The best way forward to me is to build a WTO for data, build international standards around data and technology, mm-hmm. and then let China know, just like they had to conform to international standards to join the WTO, they would have to do the same thing if they want their data and technology to interoperate with other societies. The rest of the world is much, much bigger than China alone, and if we take advantage of that, we can get real concessions.
Final thing, do you see a particular either foreign policy or economic realm that is not being discussed enough? Because we go to, you know, Syria and North Korea, Russia, China, in terms of geopolitical and economic foes. But looking into Central, South America, do you see anything that that jumps out at you in regards to there being opportunity or challenges that are confronting the United States with geopolitical and economic issues?
Well, we should do our best to keep the countries in Central and South America stable and secure, because to the extent that they have instability, migrant crises can bring people right to our borders. So that's something that's of constant concern to us. But I do believe the bigger problems are the ones that we're talking about with Iran and Russia and China. I'm particularly concerned that China is set to leapfrog us in artificial intelligence, which is one of the foremost technologies of this era. They have more access to more data than we do, which is like food for artificial intelligence. I have sat with our technology leaders in Silicon Valley. They're concerned too. And as president, I will be a partner to our leading technology companies to make sure we maintain global leadership.
Andrew, it's always great to see you.
You too, Chris. Happy New Year, New Year's Eve, Yang Gang style here in New Hampshire. Check it out. Join us. It's going to be a blast.
That is Andrew Yang. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, along with Paul Steinhauser, as we wrap up this edition of the show today. So, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Michael Bennett, all in the Granite State this weekend. Biden and Warren have been dropping a little bit in the polls. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because you don't want to have the intensity and scrutiny of being a frontrunner. Both are still within shouting distance. There is a narrative out there, though, that Warren and Biden are, in fact, slipping. Do you believe that? Or are they, you know, just being a little bit foxy at this point in time, waiting for the moment which they're going to spry up and head to the top?
Yeah, I don't let any one poll change my mind. I think when you average all the latest polls, you know, in the early voting states, and that's really what matters, it's a four-way race, right, between Biden and Warren, Sanders, and now Buttigieg in the last month. So while one poll may say one thing and another, if when you average them all together, I think you get a clearer picture. Now, nationally, Biden remains the clear frontrunner nationally, though his margins or his leads are a lot smaller now than they were back in the spring and the summer. But national polling, again, is
right.
Not so useful.
No, these polls that matter are the polls in Iowa, yeah. New Hampshire, and South Carolina, where the early voting is going to take place.
And Nevada.
One more thing. Been hearing from a couple of Republican strategists who join me on the New Hampshire Now program frequently, Tom Rath and Mike Dennehy,
that they feel that something is going on with Bloomberg, and they feel that Bloomberg is in fact going to be able to perhaps have success in this race. To me, I just don't see that at all. I see a shot for Bloomberg, but things have to work out pretty close to perfectly for him, and that would mean Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren running off with the nomination together, and Buttigieg and Joe Biden both falling flat in Iowa and all the early four states, and then him to be the last man standing against two progressives who are splitting the vote. And that, to me, is really like the only chance he has a shot. I don't even think he's going to win that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, the reason Bloomberg didn't run the first time back in February or early March when he made his announcement was because he knew Joe Biden was going to get in the race. So until Joe Biden collapses, there's really no path for Bloomberg. I don't care how much money he spends, and it's already getting up there close to over $150 million.
Right. And so either Biden or Buttigieg are going to be the moderate standard bearers after the early four states. And I don't see how both of them do so poorly that Bloomberg becomes a better option than one of them. So, yeah, I think that this is – I would – you know, if Michael Bloomberg wants to invest in this radio show, and he might have more success in terms of
– I think that may be on his agenda. I think you'd appreciate that as well. And we won't see Bloomberg here, obviously. Right. He's not campaigning in the early voting states. One last thing, because we got to get this out there. John Delaney, if you've seen his tweets lately, this guy is jacked. He's been sparking some interest with these exercises. He's like the modern-day Jack LaLanne.
Right.
But yeah, for a guy who's in his mid-50s, I got to say he's by far the candidate with the best, you know, the best physical features than any of them.
I'll leave that up to you. I'm not going to comment any further.
You know, he's,
yeah. That's fine.
I didn't say I have attraction to him. He's a good-looking man, but he does nothing for me.
That's the type of analysis we're looking for here.
Yeah,
on Background. It's getting late.
We got a little levity there at the end.
As Paul Steinhauser, I'm Chris Ryan. This is On Background, presented by the Hampshire Healthcare Association. Caring for those who care for you. More information, check out nhhca.org.